WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans aren't aware that 8 German saboteurs landed on American beaches during World War II with the mission of crippling U.S. industry. The mission was a spectacular failure. At the order of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the men were tried by military tribunal. In fact, that's the precedent the Bush administration has cited for the use of military tribunals today for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees. My guest, journalist Gary Cohn, tells the story of the German saboteurs in an article called The Keystone Commandos, published in the February edition of the Atlantic Monthly. Let's start with the acts of sabotage the Germans had planned.
Just around Pearl Harbor, the Germans had planned, they had studied American war efforts so carefully and minutely. They knew exactly that our Achilles heel was the transportation of coal from the mines in West Virginia and Pennsylvania to the steel mills in Pittsburgh. So their thought was, if they could blow up those railway lines that connected the coal mines to the steel mills, then the U.S. wouldn't be able to build tanks, airplanes, ships. So they trained men in sabotage efforts, specifically how to blow up railroad bridges, railway lines, hydroelectric plants, aiming for the hydroelectric plant in Niagara Falls, which would have served the Northeast, as well as the hydroelectric plants in the Tennessee Valley, which would have covered the South and Southeast. So they knew that if they could take out the electrical plants, and they knew if they could take out the railway lines, the Eastern Seaboard would be crippled. We would not be able to manufacture anything for the war, and that they could win. So the only thing missing were to find the men that could pull such a job off.
I just want to add here that you say they also planned to bomb Jewish-owned department stores just to terrorize people.
Right, that was sort of their Achilles heel. We sort of joke that Jewish-owned department stores is redundant. In the 1940s, I guess, the bulk of the department stores were Jewish. All they wanted to do was send a message. I guess we were here. It's interesting. It's just, again, the parallels to September 11th. It wasn't like they were supposed to leave notes. This was planted by the Nazis. They were just going to create terror and havoc and, I guess, erode America's self-confidence in 1942. So the plan was to train men how to blow up these bridges and factories and plants. So they set up an estate just west of Berlin, and from the front of the road, all you could see was a stone house, but in back was a camp that was set up with miniature railroads and miniature bridges, and the men were trained exactly how to blow this up with the least amount of effort and with dynamite that was disguised. In the case of the railway bridges, the idea was to make dynamite that looked like coal. They would then throw the coal into the railway cars, the coal would be stoked into the furnace, and then the railway would just blow up. Nobody would know if the railway blew up because of sabotage or just because of, a faulty engine. So the Germans were smart like that.
Who was the brains behind this outfit? Who organized it?
Sure. It was a man named Walter Kappe, who had been a German immigrant, moved to Kankakee, Illinois, and then moved to Chicago. And then during the Depression, I think realized that America wasn't the place to be. So he moved back to Germany and became instrumental in the early years of the Nazi Party. And it was his knowledge of America. And the other thing that the Germans were aided by was there was an intensive German-American community in cities like New York and Chicago. The hope that the Germans in Germany had was that they would be aided by these people. And it's funny because the neighborhoods are still standing. The German-American community centered in New York around East 86th Street and 3rd Avenue, and in Chicago in what's called Old Town, North Avenue. And so the hope was that the Germans in Germany would have agents living in New York and Chicago that could help them, basically what we would call today as cells.
And what was the approach to recruiting men to actually invade America?
They wanted men who could pass, who had lived here in America, who they didn't have to train how to be American necessarily. So the first group of 8 men had all come over here in the 20s, had all gone through the same kind of experience Kappe had, where during the Depression they weren't getting jobs, they were being laid off. And in the late 1930s, the German government offered a repatriation program. Anyone who wanted to come back to Germany was given a one-way boat ticket back. So all eight of these men had lived here, worked as things like janitors, as elevator operators, waiters, cooks, so didn't exactly rise in America. But when they got over to Germany, they found that it wasn't much better. They ended up all working at a Volkswagen factory or running the film projector for propaganda films. So that's why the idea of luring men to go back to America, I think these men were probably disillusioned with what they saw in Germany as well, and they kind of welcomed the chance to go back to America.
So let me see if I get this. These were Germans who had come to America because they couldn't find work in Germany. They didn't find very good work in America either. So through this repatriation program, they went back to Germany, and then they became spies and were sent back to America.
Right. And the other key was they had lived in America long enough so that nobody would look at them. And this is back to the old posters we remember seeing of loose lips sink ships. They wanted men who could pass for American.
So who was the first recruit who actually became the leader of the first group to come over to the United States for the sabotage?
The leader was a man named George Johann Dash, who had stowed away on a ship to come to New York in the 1920s, worked as a waiter, ran a house of prostitution for a while on Long Island, married a beauty operator, and when his mother came to visit him in the late 1930s, she was just full of stories about how everybody in Germany had a job, everybody worked at a factory, and she hated the idea of her 36-year-old son still working as a waiter, so she convinced him to move back to Germany. Dash moved back, and then Dash was ordered to report to an office. The German Abwehr, which was the equivalent of the CIA, had when these men had signed up for the repatriation program, they also left an extensive paper trail that the German government then poured through, found that Dash had all these qualifications, and signed him up to be the first recruit on this spy mission. This was around October, November 41, so we weren't at war yet, but I guess everyone sensed war was imminent. And once we entered the war, that's when this training program started.
Who were some of the other recruits, and were they up to the job? Were they good at being spies?
No, we have almost this sense of Teutonic efficiency and order. Maybe it's just from watching too many movies or something. These guys, the Germans in Germany, were actually very organized and very methodical in plotting the sabotage. It's just that the men that they picked were kind of lackluster. They were all, like I said, in their mid to late 30s. Disillusioned with jobs as waiters and cooks, but never really ambitious, never really climbed a ladder. So when somebody said, "Do you want to get on a submarine back to America?" They most of them were unmarried and none of them had kids. So there was nothing keeping them back in Germany. And the German government pretty much strong-armed them and said, "Show up for this mission." They felt almost proud to have been picked, but they weren't the hardcore Nazis, the brown shirt, the heel-clicking German soldiers that we think of. I think these were more just guys in the German middle class.
The German government made these saboteurs sign contracts. What did the contracts say?
They said that if they were to be killed on this mission, then the German government would give their widows a predetermined amount of money. They wanted the widows to marry within a year to keep up the pretense. And they said if they were successful in sabotage and blowing up America, that after the war, they would all be guaranteed good jobs. And in the case of one job, the contract said they guaranteed a man who had studied to be an optician that they would give him his own factory. So, again, not the greatest incentive to want to risk your life, but I think these men figured they had nothing else. It was either that or serve in the German army, go to the front, go fight Russia. So these men chose the submarine.
This contract also said that they were obliged to keep this mission a secret for the rest of their lives, and if they spoke about it to anyone, what would happen?
They would be killed. Their families would be killed. Again, it's almost out of a movie. The threats sounded almost too good to be true, but the men signed it.
So after the training, two U-boats with four would-be saboteurs in each boat headed to the United States. Where did they land?
One U-boat landed just west of Amagansett, Long Island, about 90 miles from Manhattan, and the other in Ponte Vedros Beach, Florida, which is just south of Jacksonville. They arrived about 2 weeks after leaving France.
They left from France?
Yeah, the west coast of Germany had taken over France by that time, and so the U-boat launching site was on the very western tip of France, Bordeaux,
And how far did they get in their mission?
Well, it depends. They landed. They landed without much effort, especially the team in Florida. It was as easy as landing the U-boat about 100 yards from shore, being set out in a little rubber pontoon boat, and the men arrived, buried their dynamite in the sand, waited until daybreak, and then just played in the surf, played football or whatever you play in the water in the mornings, got on a bus, went to Jacksonville, and then got on a train to Chicago, where they all had friends and family. Nobody spotted them, and if anybody saw them, they would just think they're four friends frolicking in the surf. The Long Island crew had a little more problem. As soon as they landed, or a couple minutes after their rubber raft hit the shore, a 21-year-old Coast Guardsman named John Cullen was on his round. At the time, our idea of homeland security was to have Coast Guardsmen carrying a flashlight, walking up and down the beaches. There was no military presence on the beach, or at least not where these men were in Long Island. So the Coast Guardsman sees them, asks them, "What are you doing here?" This was around 2 in the morning in June. And because the men were trained in English, one of them, that Jash, the leader of the group, said that "We're fishermen. We've run aground. We'll wait here until daylight." All that sounded fine until the two men in charge of rowing the rubber boat started hollering at each other in German. That's when Cullen realized that these were actually German soldiers. And then Dash offered to bribe Cullen and said, "I'll give you $300 if you basically look the other way and don't report this to anyone." Cullen took the money and then ran back to his Coast Guard station. "We've been invaded, we've been invaded." The men at the Coast Guard station were also equally, I don't know if ill-trained is the right word. They'd never shot a rifle before, but they had rifles at the Coast Guard station. Cullen said later he was afraid that they would all end up shooting each other rather than the Germans. So the Coast Guardsmen come back to the beach, but it was so foggy they couldn't find the men. But eventually they did find the dynamite, because one of the men had left his German, basically a German hat and a wool bathing suit that they knew had been left by the Germans. It turned out later it was left on purpose. One of the Germans wanted to leave a clue. They wanted to get caught. But while Cullen and his men were combing the sand with their rifles, the Germans had crawled through some dunes along a road and then found the Long Island Railroad, followed the tracks into the tiny town of Amagansett, and were just sitting, waiting patiently for a train. The train came in around 6:40 in the morning, and the men took it into Jamaica Station on Long Island, where the trains, you transfer from diesel train to electric. So by the time the FBI and the Army and everyone were notified that we'd been invaded, the men had already changed trains and gone into Manhattan. It would have been impossible to find them.
But two of them actually wanted to get caught. Why?
They decided, I think in retrospect, they probably knew all along, or at least during the U-boat, that this mission could never have worked, that four men could not have taken down the Niagara Falls power plant or the Hellgate Bridge, the giant railroad bridge that connects Manhattan with New England. And also, they were given $90,000 by the German government, which is the equivalent, we figured out, of almost $1 million today. They were given the name of a handler that lived in Hoboken, New Jersey, a priest who they said was a German spy. But there was nobody waiting for them in Amagansett. There was no, I guess you'd say now, adult supervision of these Germans. They were completely on their own. And so by the time the U-boat landed, they just realized this will never work. And also these men had lived enough in America, so they knew actually what they were coming back to. And maybe after spending some time back in Nazi Germany, they may have realized America wasn't so bad after all.
My guest is journalist Gary Cohen. He writes about the 1942 German sabotage plot in the February edition of the Atlantic Monthly. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. In this month's edition of the Atlantic Monthly, my guest Gary Cohen writes about a 1942 German plot to cripple American industry. 8 German saboteurs landed by U-boat on 2 American beaches. The plot was foiled by 2 of the saboteurs. So 2 of the guys in the boat that landed on Long Island wanted to get caught. They did what afterwards?
Then they all came into Manhattan, like I said. So as the FBI is realizing we've been invaded, the men who had been on a U-boat for 2 weeks took some of their $90,000 and showed up at the automat in Herald Square. And because they hadn't eaten in 2 weeks, they started ordering everything out of the machines. I don't know if your listeners remember automats, but these were these early vending machines where you would put in a quarter and get a full chicken dinner or a piece of pie. So these men went wild at the automat. Then they went to Macy's right next door and bought all new clothes because they had none. And they basically had fun in America. And then that night or the next day, two of the men, George Dash and another man, Ernest Berger, actually had a frank talk, and they both realized that neither of them wanted to go through with this mission. So eventually Berger and Dash decided to form their own team, stay away from the other two men who they weren't sure which side they were on, I guess is the way to say it. And then on Thursday, so the men had 5 days in New York where they did nothing but eat, shop, go to jazz clubs, and then hire hookers. With their $90,000, they were basically having the time of their life. They were in no rush to go back to Amagansett and pick up their dynamite and everything that they had left. So on Thursday, Dash took the train down here to Washington, checked into the Mayflower Hotel, and on Friday morning, he picked up the phone and just asked information to connect him with the FBI. And he said, "I just landed my U-boat in Amagansett, and I want to turn myself in." Well, the FBI normally has a desk for what they call nutcases, but because they... and I'd seen one, you know, this is where people call and say, you know, "I'm Cleopatra" or something. So they would have treated Dash like a nut, except the FBI knew that we had been invaded in Amagansett. I don't think in a million years they thought the Germans would actually show up in Washington and just call the FBI's main number and turn themselves in. So Dash said, "I'm here at the Mayflower." The FBI came to get him, and they kept him for about 4 days, interrogating him about everything that the Germans had planned for the U.S. In this interrogation, Dash told them how to find the other seven men. He knew where the other men were staying in New York, and he had a sense of where in Chicago the Jacksonville crew would be going. So the FBI rounded up the other seven men while Dash is being interrogated. Then finally they told Dash, because of all the work you've given, we will get you a presidential pardon. Dash said later they even promised him a ticker tape parade to be an American hero. But they said, "We're going to arrest you, and you have to pretend that you're part of this group too. And then in a couple months, you go through the whole process, and then we'll spring you." So Dash agreed to this oral promise of a presidential pardon. He was arrested along with the others. And then history kind of conflicts itself. Dash was never given a presidential pardon. He was arrested and tried, like all the others, in a military tribunal.
Now, why did Roosevelt create a military tribunal for these eight German saboteurs? And I ask that in part because, you know, the Bush administration has cited the FDR decision to create this military tribunal as a precedent for the Bush administration to create military tribunals for the detainees from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Right. Well, in 1942, we were officially at war. We were 6 months into war. And there were precedents set in both the Civil War and even as far back as the Revolutionary War that said if anyone is caught for espionage or sabotage, then the president has a way of pulling them out of the normal civil court procedure and trying them in a military tribunal. The key word for both the 1942 tribunal and today's tribunal is secrecy. The reason Roosevelt was so hell-bent on having a military tribunal was everything would be kept secret until after the war. What they didn't want Germany to know was both how unguarded our shores were, how easy it would have been to land a U-boat, as well as the fact that the Germans actually just showed up at the FBI and basically turned himself in. They wanted the message to be that the U.S. picked these men up. They joked that Hoover wanted it to sound like maybe he had been standing at the shore when the U-boat landed. And nothing could be further from the truth.
So secrecy was very important.
Right. And the whole tribunal was kept secret until about 18 years after the war, or at least until after Roosevelt died.
So nobody knew what had really happened until 18 years afterwards.
No, but Hoover
Nobody
in the public. But Hoover had taken the initiative with the press, and the front page of every paper across country was, eight Nazi saboteurs arrested. What they did is they fudged the dates. They made it sound like they didn't give the exact date that the men landed, so it sounded like they were arrested on the shore. And the plan, I should back up, but the plan for Germany was to start sending a U-boat every 6 weeks. There were men already still back at that training camp outside of Berlin, learning how to blow up bridges. The plan was eventually to move to Chicago. Cappy, the head of the organization, would move to Chicago. And with the $90,000, George Dash was told to buy a farm or a small house in the Poconos. Again, the proximity to that region of Pennsylvania being all important. So the $90,000 wasn't just to go to Macy's and hire hookers. They actually had a plan to, just kind of establish themselves in that region.
Gary Cohen writes about the German sabotage plot in the February edition of the Atlantic Monthly. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about a German plot to cripple American industry and terrorize Americans during World War II. In 1942, 8 German saboteurs landed by U-boat on 2 American beaches. But the plan was foiled by 2 of the saboteurs. President Roosevelt ordered the creation of a military tribunal to try the 8 men. Now President Bush is using that tribunal as the precedent for the creation of military tribunals to try the Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees. My guest Gary Cohn writes about the German sabotage case in the February edition of the Atlantic Monthly. What were the rules regulating this military tribunal?
Well, the men were guaranteed a lawyer. They were given a lawyer. They decided that instead of trying all 8 men, since Dash and Berger did work to turn themselves in, they would have their own lawyer. The other 6 would have a lawyer. So the men were guaranteed a lawyer, and instead of there being a judge, it was never to be called a trial. It was always called a tribunal. It was 7 judges pulled from the military. And defending the U.S. was the Attorney General at the time, Francis Biddle. And he was assisted by a half dozen lawyers, including a very young Lloyd Cutler, who eventually became Jimmy Carter's chief counsel, Clinton's counsel, and he was now working with President Bush on advising him on tribunals. So there were lawyers working for the government and then also representing the saboteurs.
Yeah, who represented the saboteurs?
A lawyer named Kenneth Royal. Who had come from, I think, trained at Harvard Law School. They were good lawyers.
What grounds did the defense attorneys use to defend their clients?
Because we were at war, there was a separate set of rules. But these men, the defense attorneys made the point, and they were right. The men didn't actually commit any sabotage. Yes, they landed on American shores with enough dynamite to blow up Niagara Falls, but they never went back to get the dynamite. They never showed any interest in going back. That they argued that really the only thing they would be guilty of is almost a probably heightened version of trespassing, you know, arriving in American shores illegally. But certainly not, it's not like they were caught at Niagara Falls ready to pull the plug.
So what were they found guilty of?
They were found guilty of sabotage, which is a key point. Espionage means spying, and sabotage just means blowing up. I think the whole time, and this is what has come out later, Roosevelt really pushed this through. No one on the tribunal was going to defy the president. And also, again, we were at war. We wanted to send a message to Germany and to any of our other enemies, A, that we could capture these men pretty easily, and also if they're captured, they're sentenced to death. And it stopped the Germans from sending anyone else over by U-boat, even though it could have been pretty easy. The Germans had a map. They had already planned their next few landing places along New Jersey and up in Maine. So the Germans knew that we were vulnerable. But the fact that we arrested these men and captured them sort of put the kibosh on any more plans to send U-boats full of saboteurs.
Now, Dash, the guy who led the mission to Long Island and who spoke to the FBI and ratted out the whole plan, he was told by the FBI that if he kind of played along, they would eventually give him a presidential pardon. But he never got that pardon. Do you know why he never got the pardon?
Dash wrote a book later and basically it said he was double-crossed. There was no way an FBI agent in Washington could guarantee a presidential pardon. Dash said that Hoover himself guaranteed it, but it's still not the same. But yet they did testify at the tribunal. The FBI agent that offered him the presidential pardon was called by the tribunal, and yes, they played back everything that the FBI had promised Dash, which is why at the end of the tribunal, Dash and Berger, the man that he had talked this over with in New York, and who had also cooperated with the FBI in giving information about the Germans' plans, their death sentences were commuted to life in prison for Berger and 30 years for Dash.
And how much time did Dash actually end up serving?
Just about 6 years. In 1948, after the war was over, a reporter for Newsweek broke the initial story that we didn't capture these men as soon as they landed. And he had found the information that they had a week or two in New York and Chicago of playtime. And when that story broke, I think it was more an embarrassment than anything else. So President Truman ordered both Dash and Berger, deported out of the country. They left Leavenworth, were put on a ship back to Germany, and basically they became that book that we all read in junior high, The Men Without a Country. They were pilloried in Germany for turning state's evidence. So eventually Berger fled to Spain and Dash fled to Switzerland.
Why did you want to write about this foiled sabotage plan from 1942?
I've always known about the story. It's part of Washington lore about the tribunal and eventually their execution here in Washington. But I think as I started reading, I saw all of the parallels between the men of 1942 and some of the terrorists of September 11th, that you look at some of the eerie coincidences, like the fact that the men were able to just infiltrate so easily, that they were given large amounts of cash. And the only difference is that the men in 1942, you could tell their hearts weren't in it. Maybe the promise of a job in an optical factory after it was over just didn't hold the same allure. Also, these men weren't told to put their lives in danger. And the men told the FBI that they were told in Germany that they would try and limit civilian casualties. I guess it's hard when you plant a bomb in a department store. But notice that these activities were really just to shut down an electric plant or take down a railroad line. They weren't to create the same kind of terror that the September 11th terrorists. So we started writing the story in October, November, and around the same time with President Bush and the military tribunals, I think it was just a nice stroke of luck that Bush cited Roosevelt's order just as I was finishing up writing the story.
How did you get access to the trial transcripts?
There's one copy in existence that it's up at the Franklin Roosevelt Archives in the Franklin Roosevelt Library up in Hyde Park, New York. And what I did is I spent a week just reading the 3,000 pages every day in Hyde Park. And then in here at the National Archives out in College Park, Maryland, are the actual FBI interviews with these men before they were executed. So my story is kind of a nice marriage of the tribunal and the interviews with the men, as well as some old news clips that I found at the Library of Congress. So I tried to rely on as many first-person sources as I could.
Do you have a favorite part of the trial transcript?
No, I have a favorite clip, though. I grew up in South Bend, Indiana, and there was an article from the South Bend Tribune where they polled the readers, what should we do with these Nazis? And I think out of 1,050 responses, 1,049 said these men should be executed. And one of the readers sent in some money, said that the men should be fed to Gargantua, a circus gorilla who happened to be touring South Bend at the time. And he sent money for Gargantua's funeral because he said, quote, Gargantua would surely die of poisonous eating after eating the eight Nazis.
Well, Gary Cohen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Cohen writes about the World War II German sabotage case in the February edition of the Atlantic Monthly. This is Fresh Air.